Chapter 6. The Masked Troubadour. A young man came out of the Drones Club and paused on the steps to light a cigarette. As he did so, there popped up, apparently through the pavement, for there had been no sign of him in the street a moment before, a seedy individual who touched his hat and smiled ingratiatingly. The young man seemed to undergo a brief struggle. Then he felt in his pocket, pressed a coin into the outstretched palm, and passed on. It was a pretty, heartwarming little scene, the sort of thing you see in full-page pictures in the Christmas numbers. But the only emotion it excited in the bosoms of the two beans who'd witnessed it from the window of the smoking room was amazement.
"Well, stap my vitals," said the first bean. "If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it."
"Nor me," said the second bean.
"Believed what?"
asked a crumpet who'd come up behind them. The two beans turned to him as one bean and spoke in alternate lines, like a Greek chorus.
"Freddie Widgeon
was outside there a moment ago.
And a chap came up and touched his hat.
And then he touched Freddie.
And Freddie, though he was on the steps at the time,
and so had only to leap backwards in order to win to safety,
stood there and let the deal go through."
The crumpet clicked his tongue.
What sort of a looking chap was he? Small and a bit greasy?
Quite fairly greasy.
I thought as much, said the crumpet. I know the bird. He's a fellow named Waterbury, a pianist by profession. He's a sort of pensioner of Freddy's. Freddie is always slipping him money, here a tanner, there a bob.
The astonishment of the two beans deepened.
But Freddie's broke, said the senior bean.
True, said the crumpet. He can ill spare these bobs and tanners, but that old noblesse oblige spinet of his has cropped up again. He feels that he must allow himself to be touched, because this greasy bird has a claim on him. He saved his life.
The greasy bird saved Freddy's life?
No, Freddy saved the greasy bird's life.
Then Freddy ought to be touching the greasy bird.
Not according to the code of the Widgeons.
The crumpet sighed.
Poor old Freddy. It's a shame, this constant drain on his meagre resources, after all he's been through.
What's he been through? Asked the junior bean.
You would not be far out, replied the crumpet gravely, if you said that he had been through the furnace. At the time when this story opens, said the crumpet, Freddie was feeling a bit low. His heart had just been broken, and that always pulls him down. He had loved Dahlia Prenderby with every fibre of his being, and she'd handed him the horse's laugh. He was, therefore, as you may suppose, in no mood for social gaiety, and when he got a note from his uncle, old Blister, asking him to lunch at the Ritz, his first impulse was to refuse. But as Lord Blister was the source from which proceeded his quarterly allowance, he couldn't do that, of course. The old boy's invitations were commands. So he turned up at the eating house and was sitting in the lobby thinking long, sad thoughts of Dahlia Prenderby when his host walked in.
"Ah, Frederick,"
he said, having eased his topper and umbrella off onto a member of the staff.
"Glad you were able to come. I want to have a serious talk with you. I've been thinking a lot about you lately."
"Have you, Uncle?" said Freddy, touched.
"Yes,"
said old Blister.
"Wondering why you were such a blasted young blot on the escutcheon and trying to figure out some way of stopping you being the world's worst ass and pest. And I think I've found the solution. It would ease the situation very much, in my opinion, if you got married. Don't puff like that. What the devil are you puffing for?"
"I was sighing, Uncle."
"Well, don't. Good God, I thought you'd got asthma. Yes,"
said Lord Blister.
"I believe that if you were married and settled down, things might brighten considerably all round. I've known bigger... well, no, scarcely that, perhaps. I've known very nearly as big fools as you improve out of all recognition by marriage. And here's what I wanted to talk to you about. You will no doubt have been wondering why I'm buying you a lunch in an infernally expensive place like this. I will tell you. My old friend, Lady Pinfield, is joining us in a few minutes with her daughter, Dora. I've decided that she is the girl you shall marry. Excellent family, plenty of money of her own, and sense enough for two, which is just the right amount. So, mind you make yourself attractive, if that's humanly possible, to Dora Pinfold.
A weary, mirthless smile twisted Freddy's lips.
All this,
he began.
And let me give you a warning. She is not one of your fast modern girls, so bear in mind when conversing with her that you're not in the smoking room of the Drones Club. Only carefully selected stories, and no limericks whatsoever.
All this,
began Freddy again.
Don't drink anything at lunch. She's strict in her views about that. And talking of lunch, when the waiter comes round with the menu, don't lose your head. Keep an eye on the prices in the right-hand column.
All this,
said Freddy at last, getting a word in,
is very kind of you, Uncle, and I appreciate it. Your intentions are good, but I cannot marry this girl.
Old Blister nodded intelligently.
I see what you mean. You feel it would be a shabby trick to play on any nice girl. True, there's much in what you say. But somebody has got to suffer in this world. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. So, never mind the ethics of the thing. You go ahead and fascinate her, or I'll... Oh, shh! Here they come.
He got up and started to stump forward to greet a stout, elderly woman who was navigating through the doorway. And Freddy, following, suddenly halted in his tracks and nearly took a toss. He was looking at the girl floating along in the wake of the stout woman. In a blinding flash of revelation, he saw Delia Prenderby and all the other girls who had turned him down. Just boyish infatuations, he could see now. This was his soulmate.
There was none like her, none.
Freddy, as you know, always falls in love at first sight, and he'd done so on this occasion, with a wallop. His knees were wobbling under him as he went in to lunch, and he was glad to be able to sit down and take the weight off them. The girls seemed to like him. Girls always do like Freddy at first. It's when the grueling test of having him in their hair for several weeks comes that they throw in the towel. Ever the fish and chips, he and this Dora Pinfold fraternized like billio. True, it was mostly a case of her telling him about her dreams and ideals and him saying, oh, ah, and oh, absolutely. But that did not alter the fact that the going was good. So much so that with the cheese, Freddy, while not actually pressing her hand, was leaning over towards her at an angle of 45 and saying why shouldn't they lap up their coffee quick at the conclusion of the meal and go and see a picture or something. And she said she would have loved it, only she had to be in Notting Hill at 3:15. I'm interested in a sort of mission there, she said.
Great Scott,
said Freddy.
Cocoa and good works, do you mean?
Yes, we're giving an entertainment this afternoon to the mothers. Freddy nearly choked over his camembert. A terrific idea had come to him. If, he reflected, he was going to meet this girl again only at dinners and dances, the usual social round, I mean to say, all she would ever get to know about him was that he had a good appetite and india rubber legs. Whereas, if he started frequenting Notting Hill in her company, he'd be able to flash his deeper self on her. He could be suave, courteous, the preux chevalier, and shower her with those little attentions which make a girl sit up and say to herself, "What ho?"
"I say,"
he said.
"Couldn't I come along?"
"Oh, it would bore you."
"Not a bit. I could hover round and shove the old dears into their seats and so on. I'm good at that. I've been an usher at dozens of weddings."
The girl reflected. "I'll tell you what you can do, if you really want to help," she said. "We are a little short of talent. Can you sing?"
"Rather."
"Then will you sing?"
"Absolutely."
"That would be awfully kind of you. Any old song will do."
"I shall sing,"
said Freddy, directing at her a glance which he rather thinks, though he's not sure, made her blush in a modest confusion.
"A number entitled When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Lovelight in Your Eyes."
So directly lunch was over, off they popped, old Blister beaming on Freddy and very nearly slapping him on the back. No wonder, for his work had unquestionably been good. And as the clocks were striking 3:30, Freddy was up on the platform with the vicar and a Union Jack behind him, the girl Dora at the piano at his side, and about 200 Notting Hill mothers in front of him, letting it go like a Crosby. He was a riot. Those mothers, he tells me, just sat back and ate it up. He did two songs, and they wanted a third. He did a third, and they wanted an encore. He did an encore, and they started whistling through their fingers till he came on and bowed. And when he came on and bowed, they insisted on a speech. And it was at this point, as he himself realizes now, that Freddy lost his cool judgment. He allowed himself to be carried away by the intoxication of the moment and went too far. Briefly, what happened was that, in a few cordial words, he invited all those present to be his guests at a binge to be held in the Mission Hall that day week.
"Mothers," said Freddy, "this is on me. I shall expect you to the last mother. And if any mothers here have mothers of their own, I hope they will bring them along. There'll be no stint. Buns and cocoa will flow like water. I thank you, one and all."
And it was only when he got home, still blinking from the bright light which he'd encountered in the girl Dora's eyes as they met his, and still deafened by the rousing cheers which had greeted his remarks, that he remembered that all he had in the world was £1, 3 shillings and 4p. Well, you can't entertain a multitude of mothers in slap-up style on £1, 3 and 4p. So it was obvious that he would be obliged to get into somebody's ribs for something substantial. And the only person he could think of who was good for the sum he required, £20 seemed to him about the figure, was old Blister. It would not be an easy touch, he realised that. The third Earl of Blister was a man who, though well blessed with the world's goods, hated loosening up. Moths had nested in his pocketbook for years and raised large families. However, one of the fundamental facts of life is that you can't pick and choose when you want £20. You have to go to the man who's got £20. So he went round to tackle the old boy. There was a bit of a lull when he got to the house. Some sort of by-election, it appeared, was pending down at Bottleton in the East End, and Lord Blister had gone off there to take the chair at a meeting in the Conservative interest. So Freddy had to wait. But eventually he appeared, a bit hoarse from addressing the proletariat, but in excellent fettle. He was very bucked at the way Freddy had shaped at the luncheon table.
"You surprised me, my boy," he said. "I'm really beginning to think that if you continue as you've begun and are careful when you propose to do it in a dim light so that she can't get a good look at you, you may win that girl."
"And you want me to win her, don't you, Uncle?"
"I do indeed."
"Then will you give me £20?
The sunlight died out of Lord Blister's face.
£20? What do you want £20 for?
"It is vital that I acquire that sum," said Freddy.
And in a few words he explained that he had pledged himself to lush up the mothers of Notting Hill on buns and cocoa a week from that day, and that if he welched and failed to come through, the girl would never forgive him, and rightly. Lord Blister listened with growing gloom. He'd set his heart on this union, but the overhead made him quiver. The thought of parting with £20 was like a dagger in his bosom.
"It won't cost £20.
"It will."
"You can do it on much less than that."
"I don't see how. There must have been fully 200 mothers present. They'll bring friends and relations. Add gatecrashers, and I can't budget for less than 400 at a bob a knob."
Lord Blister pshawed.
"Preposterous!"
he cried.
"A bob a knob, forsooth! Cocoa's not expensive!"
"But the buns. You're forgetting the buns."
"Buns aren't expensive either."
"Well, how about hard-boiled eggs? Have you reflected, Uncle, that there may be hard-boiled eggs?"
"Hard-boiled eggs? Good God, boy! What is this thing you're planning? A Babylonian orgy? There'll be no question of hard-boiled eggs."
"Well, all right. Then let us return to the buns. allowing 12 per person...
Don't be absurd. 12, indeed? These are simple, God-fearing English mothers you're entertaining, not tapeworms. I'll give you £10. 10 is ample.
And nothing that Freddy could say would shake him. It was with a brace of fivers in his pocket that he left the other's presence, and every instinct in him told him that they would not be enough. 15 quid, in his opinion, was the irreducible minimum. He made his way to the club in pensive mood, his brain darting this way and that, in the hope of scaring up some scheme for adding to his little capital. He was still brooding on a problem which seemed to grow each moment more hopeless of solution when he entered the smoking room and found a group of fellows there, gathered about a kid in knickerbockers. And not only were they gathered about this kid, they were practically fawning on him. This surprised Freddy. He knew that a chap has to have something outstanding about him to be fawned upon at the Drones, and nothing in this child's appearance suggested that he was in any way exceptional. The only outstanding thing about him was his ears.
"What's all this?"
he asked of Catsmeat Potter Purbright, who was hovering on the outskirts of the group. "It's Barmy Phipps' cousin Egbert from Harrow," said Catsmeat. "Most remarkable chap. You see that catapult he's showing those birds? Well, he puts a Brazil nut in it and wangs off at things and hits them every time. It's a great gift, and you might think it would make him conceited. But no, success has not spoiled him. He's still quite simple and unaffected. Would you like his autograph?" Freddy, frankly, did not believe the story. The whole nature of a Brazil nut, it being knobbly and of a rummy, semicircular shape, unfits it to act as a projectile. The thing he felt might be just barely credible, perhaps of one who was receiving his education at Eton, but Catsmeat had specifically stated that this lad was at Harrow, and his reason revolted at the idea of a Harrovian being capable of such a feat.
"What rot," he said.
"It isn't rot," said Catsmeat Potter Purbright, stung. "Only just now he picked off a passing errand boy as clean as a whistle."
"Pure fluke."
"Well, what'll you bet he can't do it again?"
A thrill ran through Freddy. He'd found the way.
"A fiver,"
he cried. Well, of course, Catsmeat hadn't got a fiver. But he swiftly formed a syndicate to cover Freddy's money, and the stakes were deposited with the chap behind the bar, and a Brazil nut provided for the boy Egbert at the club's expense. And it was as he fitted nut to elastic that Catsmeat Potter Purbright said,
"Look! Look!" said Catsmeat Potter Purbright. "There's a taxi just drawing up with a stout buffer in it. Will you make this stout buffer the test? Will you bet that Egbert here doesn't knock off his topper as he pays the cabby?"
"Certainly,"
said Freddy. The cab stopped. The buffer alighted, his top hat gleaming in the sunshine. The child Egbert, with incredible nonchalance, drew his bead. The Brazil nut sang through the air, and the next moment Freddy was staggering back with his hands to his eyes, a broken man. For the hat, struck squarely abaft the binnacle, had leapt heavenwards, and he was down 5 quid. And the worst was yet to come. About a minute later, he was informed that Lord Blister had called to see him. He went to the small smoking room and found his uncle standing on the hearthrug. He was staring in a puzzled sort of way at a battered top hat which he held in his hand.
"Most extraordinary thing," he said. "As I was getting out of my cab just now, something suddenly came whizzing out of the void and knocked my hat off. I think it must have been a small meteor. I'm going to write to the Times about it. But never mind that. What I came for was to get 50 shillings from you."
Freddy had already tottered on discovering that it was old Blister who'd been the victim of the boy Egbert's uncanny skill. These words made him totter again. That his uncle should be touching him, instead of him touching his uncle, gave him a sort of goose-fleshy feeling, as if he were rubbing velvet the wrong way.
50 shillings,
he bleated.
£2.10, said old Blister, making it clear to the meanest intelligence. After you left me, I was dissatisfied with your figures. So I went and consulted my cook, a most capable woman, as to the market price of buns and cocoa. And what she told me convinces me that you can do the whole thing comfortably on £7.10. So I hurried here to recover the 50 shillings which I overpaid you. I can give you change.
5 minutes later, Freddy was at a writing table with pen and paper, trying to work out how he stood. Of his original capital, £2.10 remained. According to his uncle, who had it straight from the cook's mouth, buns and cocoa could be provided for 400 at a little over fourpence a head. It seemed incredible. But he knew that his uncle's cook, a level-headed woman named Bessemer, was to be trusted implicitly on points of this kind. No doubt the explanation was that a considerable reduction was given for quantity. When you buy your buns by the ton, you get them cheaper. Very well, then. The deficit to be made up appeared still to be £5, and where he was to get it was more than he could say. He couldn't very well go back to old Blister and ask for a further donation, giving as his reason the fact that he had lost a fiver betting that a kid with windjammer ears wouldn't knock his, old Blister's, hat off with a Brazil nut. Then what to do? It was all pretty complex, and I'm not surprised that for the next 2 or 3 days, Freddy was at a loss. During these days, he continued to haunt Notting Hill. But though he was constantly in the society of the girl Dora, and though he was treated on all sides as the young Lord Bountiful, he could not bring himself to buck up and be fizzy. Wherever he went, the talk was all of this forthcoming Beano of his, and it filled him with a haunting dread. Notting Hill was plainly planning to go for the buns and cocoa in a big way, and who, this was what he asked himself, who was going to foot the bill? The ironical thing, he saw now, was that his original capital would have seen him through. There had been no need whatsoever for him to go plunging like that in the endeavour to bump up the kitty. When he reflected that, but for getting his figures twisted, he would now have been striding through Notting Hill with his chin up and his chest out and not a care on his mind, he groaned in spirit. He told me so himself.
I groaned in spirit,
he said. And then, one afternoon, after he'd explored every possible avenue, as he thought, without getting a bite, he suddenly stumbled on one that promised to bring home the gravy. Other avenues had let him down with a bump, but this one really did look the goods. For what happened was that he learned that on that very evening the East Bottleton Palace of Varieties was holding its monthly amateur night, and that the prize of victory, he reeled as he read the words, was a handsome £5 note. At the moment when he made this discovery, things had been looking their darkest. Freddy, in fact, was so up against it that he'd come to the conclusion that the only thing to do, if he was to fulfil his honourable obligations, was to go to his uncle, confess all, and try to tap him again. The old boy, apprised of the facts in the matter of his ruined topper, would unquestionably want to disembowel him, but he was so keen on the wedding coming off that it might just conceivably happen that he would confine himself to harsh words and, at the end of a powerful harangue, spring the much-needed. Anyway, it was his only chance. He rang up the Blister residence and was informed that the big chief was again down at Bottleton East, presiding at one of those political meetings. At the Bottleton Palace of Varieties, said the butler. So, though he would much have preferred to go to Whipsonade and try to take a mutton chop away from a tiger, Freddy had a couple of quick ones, ate a clove, and set off. I don't suppose you're familiar with Bottleton East, except by name. It's a pretty tough sort of neighbourhood, rather like Limehouse, only with fewer mysterious Chinamen. The houses are small and grey, cats abound, and anyone who has a bit of old paper or a piece of orange peel throws it on the pavement. It depressed Freddy a good deal, and he was feeling pretty well down among the wines and spirits when a burst of muffled cheering came to his ears, and he found that he was approaching the Bottleton Palace of Varieties. And he was just toddling round to send in his name to old Blister, when he saw on the wall this poster announcing the Grand Amateur Night, and the glittering reward offered to the performer who clicked. It altered the whole aspect of things in a flash. What it meant was that that distressing interview with Lord Blister could now be pigeonholed indefinitely. Here was the five he needed, as good as in his pocket. This gay confidence on his part may surprise you, but you must remember that it was only a day or two since he'd burned up the Notting Hill mothers with his crooning. A man who could put over a socko like that had little to fear, he felt, from any opposition a place like Bottleton East could bring against him. There was just one small initial difficulty. He would require an accompanist, and it was rather a problem to see where he was to get one. At Notting Hill, you will recall, the girl Dora had tinkled the ivories on his behalf, but he could scarcely ask her to officiate on the present occasion, for, apart from anything else, secrecy was of the essence. For the same reason, he could not get anyone from the drones. The world must never know that Frederick Widgeon had been raising the wind by performing at amateur nights in the East End of London. He walked on, musing. It was an annoying little snag to crop up, just as everything looked nice and smooth. However, his luck was in. Halfway down a grubby little street, he saw a card in a window announcing that Joseph Waterbury gave piano lessons on those premises. And, rightly reasoning that a bloke who could teach the piano would also know how to accompany, he knocked at the door. And after he'd been subjected to a keen scrutiny by a mysterious eye through the keyhole, the door opened and he found himself vis-à-vis with the greasy bird whom you saw outside there just now. The first few minutes of the interview were given up to mutual explanations. Freddy handed the greasy bird his card. The greasy bird said that he would not have kept Freddy waiting, only something in the timbre of his knock had given him the idea that he was Ginger Murphy, a gentleman friend of his with whom he'd had a slight difference, and who had expressed himself desirous of seeing the colour of his insides. Freddy explained that he wanted the greasy bird to accompany him on the piano at amateur night. And the greasy bird said that Freddy couldn't have made a wiser move, because he was an expert accompanist, and having him with you on such an occasion was half the battle. After this, there was a bit of haggling about terms, but in the end it was arranged that Freddy should pay the greasy bird five bob, half a crown down, and the rest that night, and that they should meet at the stage door at 8 sharp.
"If I'm not there," said the greasy bird, "you'll find me in the public bar of the Green Goose round the corner."
"Right-ho," said Freddy. "I shall sing When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Love-Light in Your Eyes."
"Ah, well," said the greasy bird, who seemed a bit of a philosopher, "I expect worse things happen at sea."
Freddy then pushed off, on the whole satisfied with the deal. He hadn't liked this Joseph Waterbury much. Not quite the accompanist of his dreams. He would have felt kindlier towards him if he had bathed more recently and had smelled less strongly of unsweetened gin. Still, he was no doubt as good as could be had at the price. Freddy was not prepared to go higher than 5 bob, and that ruled out the chaps who play at Queen's Hall. Having completed the major preliminary arrangements, Freddy now gave thought to make-up and appearance. The other competitors, he presumed, would present themselves to their public more or less as is, but their circumstances were rather different from his own. In his case, a certain caution was indicated. His uncle appeared to be making quite a stamping ground of Bottleton East just now, and it would be disastrous if he happened to come along and see him doing his stuff. So, though it was not likely that Lord Blister would attend amateur night at the Palace of Varieties, he thought it best to be on the safe side and adopt some rude disguise. After some meditation, he decided to conceal his features behind a strip of velvet and have himself announced as the Masked Troubadour. He dined lightly at the club off oysters and a pint of stout, and at 8 o'clock, after an afternoon spent in gargling throat tonic and saying me, me, me to limber up the larynx, he arrived at the stage door. Joseph Waterbury was there, wearing the unmistakable air of a man who's been more or less submerged in unsweetened gin for several hours, and half a crown having changed hands, they proceeded to the wings together to await their turn. It was about a quarter of an hour before they were called upon, and during this quarter of an hour, Freddy tells me that his spirits soared heavenwards. It was so patently absurd, he felt, as he watched the local talent perform, to suppose that there could be any question of his ability to cop the gauge of victory. He didn't know how these things were decided, by popular acclamation, presumably, but whatever system of marking might prevail, it must inevitably land him at the head of the poll. These Bottleton songbirds were all well-meaning. They spared no pains and gave of their best, but they had nothing that could, by the remotest stretch of the word, be described as class. Five of them preceded him, and not one of the five could have held those Notting Hill mothers for a minute, let alone have wowed them as he had wowed them. These things are a matter of personality and technique. Either you have got personality and technique, or you haven't. These chaps hadn't. He had. His position, he saw, was rather that of a classic horse put up against a lot of selling platers. So, as I say, he stood there for a quarter of an hour, muttering, me, 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 and getting more and more above himself. And finally, after a cove who looked like a plumber's mate had finished singing Just Break the News to Mother and had gone off to sporadic applause, he saw the announcer jerking his thumb at him and realised that the moment had come. He was not a bit nervous, he tells me. From what he'd heard of these amateur nights, he'd rather supposed that he might for the first minute or so have to quell and dominate a pretty tough audience. But the house seemed in friendly mood, and he walked on the stage, adjusting his mask with a firm and confident tread. The first jarring note was struck when the announcer turned to inquire his name. He was a stout, puffy man with bags under his eyes and a face the colour of damson. And on seeing Freddy, he shied like a horse. He backed a step or two, throwing up his arms as he did so, in a defensive sort of way.
"It's all right,"
said Freddy. The man seemed reassured. He gulped once or twice, but became calmer.
"What's all this?"
he asked.
"It's quite all right,"
said Freddy.
"Just announce me as the Masked Troubadour."
"Cool, you gave me a nasty shock. Masked what?"
"Troubadour,"
said Freddy, spacing the syllables carefully. He walked over to the piano, where Joseph Waterbury had seated himself and was playing chords.
"Ready?"
he said. Joseph Waterbury looked up, and a slow look of horror began to spread itself over his face. He shut his eyes, and his lips moved silently. Freddy thinks he was praying.
"Buck up," said Freddy sharply. "We're just going to kick off."
Joseph Waterbury opened his eyes.
"Good,"
he said.
"Is that you?" "Of course it's me."
"What have you done to your face?"
This was a point which the audience also seemed to wish thrashed out. Interested voices made themselves heard from the gallery.
"What's all this, Bill?" "It's a masked trebada,"
said the announcer.
"What's a trebada?"
"This is..."
The damson-faced man seemed to wash his hands of the whole unpleasant affair.
"Don't blame me, boys,"
he begged.
"That's what he says he is."
Joseph Waterbury bobbed up again. For the last few moments, he'd just been sitting, muttering to himself.
"It isn't right," said Joseph Waterbury. "It isn't British. It isn't fair to lead a man on and then suddenly turn round on him."
"Shut up," hissed Freddy. All this, he felt, was subversive, getting the audience into a wrong mood. Already the patron's geniality was beginning to ebb. He could sense a distinct lessening of that all-pals-together spirit. One or two children were crying.
"Ladies and gentlemen!"
bellowed the damson-faced man.
"Less sprinkling noise, if you please. I claim your kind indulgence for this ere trebada." "That's all right,"
said Joseph Waterbury, leaving the piano and coming downstage.
"He may be a trebada, or he may not, but I appeal to this fair-minded audience. Is it just, is it ethical, for a man suddenly to pop out on a fellow who's had a couple?"
"Come on!"
cried the patrons.
"Less of it!"
And a voice in the gallery urged Joseph Waterbury to put his head in a bucket.
"All right!"
said Joseph Waterbury, who was plainly in dark mood.
"All right, but you haven't heard the last of this by any means."
He reseated himself at the piano, and Freddy began to sing "When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Love Light in Your Eyes." The instant he got going, he knew that he'd never been in better voice in his life. Whether it was the oysters, or the stout, or the throat tonic, he didn't know, but the notes were floating out as smooth as syrup. It made him feel a better man to listen to himself. And yet, there was something wrong. He spotted it almost from the start. For some reason, he was falling short of perfection. And then, suddenly, he got onto it. In order to make a song a smash, it's not enough for the singer to be on top of his form. The accompanist also must do his bit. And the primary thing a singer expects from his accompanist is that he shall play the accompaniment of the song he is singing. This Joseph Waterbury was not doing, and it was this that was causing the sweet bells jangled effect which Freddy had observed. What the greasy bird was actually playing, he could not say, but it was not the twiddly bits to "When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Love Light in Your Eyes." It was obviously a case for calling a conference. A bit of that inter-office communication stuff was required. He made a sideways leap to the piano, encouraging some of the audience to suppose that he was going into his dance.
"There is silver in the moonlight."
"What the hell are you playing?" sang Freddy.
"Aye,"
said Joseph Waterbury.
"But it's silver tarnished seams."
"You're playing the wrong song. What are you singing?"
"When it meets the golden love light."
"I'm singing When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Love Light in Your Eyes, you silly ass."
"Coo,"
said Joseph Waterbury.
"I thought you told me top hat, white tie and tails. All right, cocky, now we're off."
He switched nimbly into the correct channels, and Freddy was able to sing
"In your eyes that softly beams,"
without that set your teeth on edge feeling that he'd sometimes experienced when changing gears unskillfully in his two-seater. But the mischief had been done. His grip on the audience had weakened. The better element on the lower floor was still sticking it out like men, but up in the gallery a certain liveliness had begun to manifest itself. The raspberry was not actually present, but he seemed to hear the beating of its wings. To stave it off, he threw himself into his warbling with renewed energy. And such was his magnetism and technique that he very nearly put it over. The muttering died away. One of the crying children stopped crying, and though another was sick, Freddy thinks this must have been due to something it had eaten, he sang like one inspired.
"Ere the moon is bright and radiant, but its radiance fades and dies, when the silver of the moonlight meets the love light in your eyes."
It was when he'd reached this point, with that sort of lingering, caressing, treacly tremolo on the eyes, which makes all the difference, that the mothers of Notting Hill, unable to restrain themselves any longer, had started whooping and stamping and whistling through their fingers. And there's little doubt, he tells me, that ere long these Bottletonians would have begun expressing themselves in similar fashion, had not Joseph Waterbury, who, since the recent conference, had been as good as gold, at this moment recognised an acquaintance in the front row of the stalls. This was a large, red-haired man in a sweater and corduroy trousers, who looked as if he might be in some way connected with the jellied eel industry. His name was Murphy, and it was he who, as Joseph Waterbury had informed Freddy at their first meeting, wished to ascertain the colour of the accompanist's insides. What drew Joseph Waterbury's attention to this eel jellier, if eel jellier he was the circumstance of the latter, at this juncture, throwing an egg at him. It missed its mark, but it had the effect of causing the pianist to stop playing and rise and advance to the footlights. There was a cold look of dislike in his eyes. It was plain that there was imperfect communion of spirit between these two men. He bent over and asked, "Did you throw that egg?" To which the red-haired man's reply was,
"Arr! You did you?" said Joseph Waterbury. "Well, what price sausage and mashed?"
Freddy says he cannot understand these East End blokes. Their psychology is a sealed book to him. It's true that Joseph Waterbury had spoken in an unpleasant, sneering manner, but even so, he could see nothing in his words to stir the passions and cause a human being to lose his kinship with the divine. Personally, I'm inclined to think that there must have been some hidden significance in them, wounding the eel jellier's pride. So that when Joseph Waterbury said,
"What price sausage and mashed?"
the phrase did not mean to him what it would to you or me, but something deeper. Be that as it may, it brought the red-haired chap to his feet, howling like a gorilla. The position of affairs was now as follows. The red-haired chap was saying, "Wait till he got Joseph Waterbury outside." Joseph Waterbury was saying that he could eat the red-haired chap for a relish with his tea. Three more children had begun to cry, and the one who'd stopped crying had begun again. 40, perhaps, or it may have been 50, voices were shouting, "Oi!" The announcer was bellowing,
"Order! Please, order!"
Another infant in the gallery was being sick. And Freddy was singing verse 2 of "When the Silver of the Moonlight Meets the Love Light in Your Eyes." Even at Queen's Hall, I don't suppose this sort of thing could have gone on long. At the Bottleton Palace of Varieties, the pause before the actual outbreak of Armageddon was only of a few seconds' duration. Bottleton East is crammed from end to end with costermongers dealing in tomatoes, potatoes, Brussels sprouts and fruits in their season, and it's a very negligent audience there that forgets to attend a place of entertainment with full pockets. Vegetables of all kinds now began to fill the air, and Freddy, abandoning his art as a washout, sought refuge behind the piano. But this move, though shrewd, brought him only a temporary respite. No doubt this audience had had to deal before with singers who hid behind pianos. It took them perhaps a minute to find the range. And then some kind of dried fish came dropping from the gallery and caught him in the eye. Very much the same thing, if you remember, happened to King Harold at the Battle of Hastings. 40 seconds later, he was in the wings, brushing a tomato off his coat. In circumstances like these, you might suppose that Freddy's soul would have been a maelstrom of mixed emotions. This, however, was not the case. One emotion only gripped him. He had never been more single-minded in his life. He wanted to get hold of Joseph Waterbury and twist his head off and stuff it down his throat. It's true that the red-haired chap had started the final mix-up by throwing an egg, but an accompanist worth his salt, felt Freddy, should have treated a mere egg with silent disdain, not deserted his post in order to argue about the thing. Rightly or wrongly, he considered that it was to Joseph Waterbury that his downfall was due. But for that sozzled pianist, he held, a triumph might have been his, as outstanding as his furore at Notting Hill. Joseph Waterbury had disappeared, but fortunately Freddy was now not unfamiliar with his habits. His first act, on reaching the stage door and taking a Brussels sprout out of his hair, was to ask to be directed to the Green Goose. And there, a few moments later, he came upon the man he sought. He was standing at the counter, drinking an unsweetened gin. Now, just before the tiger of the jungle springs upon its prey, I'm told by chaps who know tigers of the jungle, there is always a moment when it pauses, flexing its muscles and rubbing its feet in the resin. It was so with Freddy at this point. He did not immediately leap upon Joseph Waterbury, but stood clenching and unclenching his fists, while his protruding eyes sought out soft spots in the man. His ears were red, and he breathed heavily. The delay was fatal. Other people were familiar with Joseph Waterbury's habits. Just as he was about to take off, the swing door flew open violently, disclosing the red-haired man. And a moment later, the red-haired man, pausing only to spit on his hands, had gone into action. The words we speak in our heat seldom stand the acid test. In the very first seconds of the encounter, it would have become plain to the poorest judge of form that, in stating that he could eat the red-haired man for a relish with his tea, Joseph Waterbury had overestimated his powers. He put up the rottenest kind of show, being as chaff before the red-haired bloke's sickle. Almost before the proceedings had begun, he had stopped a stinker with his chin and was on the sawdust. In places like Bottleton East, when you're having a scrap and your antagonist falls, you don't wait for anyone to count 10. You kick him in the slats. This is a local rule, and it was so obvious to Freddy that this was what the red-haired bird was planning to do that he didn't hesitate, but with a passionate cry, rushed into the fray. He isn't a chap who goes out of his way to get mixed up in barroom brawls, but the sight of this red-haired fellow murdering the bounder he wanted to murder himself seemed to him to give him no option. He felt that his claim was being jumped, and his generous spirit resented it. And so moved was he by the thought of being done out of his rights that he might have put up a very pretty fight indeed had not the chucker-out attached to the premises intervened. When the summons for his professional services reached him, the honest fellow had been enjoying a pint and a bit of bread and cheese in the back room. He now came in, wiping his mouth. These chuckers-out are no fools. A glance showed this one that a big, beefy, dangerous-looking chap was having a spot of unpleasantness with a slim, slight, slender chap. And, with swift intelligence and sturdy common sense, he grabbed the slim, slender chap. To pick Freddy up like a sack of coals and carry him to the door and hurl him out into the great open spaces was, with him, the work of a moment. And so it came about that Lord Brister, who was driving home after one of his meetings in the Conservative interest, became aware of stirrings afoot off stage left, and the next moment perceived his nephew Frederick coming through the air like a shooting star. He signalled to the chauffeur to stop and poked his head out of the window.
"Frederick!"
he called, not, as you may well suppose, quite grasping the gist. Freddy did not reply. Already he was re-entering the swing door in order to take up the argument at the point where it had been broken off. He was by now a bit stirred. Originally, he'd wanted to assassinate Joseph Waterbury, but since then his conception had broadened, if you know what I mean. He now wished to blot out the red-haired chap as well, also the chucker-out and anybody else who crossed his path. Old Blister emerged from the car, just in time to see his flesh and blood popping out again.
"Frederick!"
he cried.
"What is the meaning of this?"
And he seized him by the arm. Well, anybody could have told him he was asking for it. This was no time to seize Freddy by the arm. There was an arm left over which old Blister hadn't seized, and with this, Freddy smote him a snappy one in the midriff. Then, passing a weary hand over his brow, he made for the swing door again. The catch about all this sort of thing, running amok, I mean, and going berserk, or whatever they call it, is that there inevitably comes a morning after. The following morning found Freddy in bed, and so did old Blister. He appeared as early as 9 a.m, rousing Freddy from a troubled sleep, and what he wanted, it seemed, was a full explanation. And when Freddy, who was too weak for polished subterfuge, had given him a full explanation, not omitting the incident of the Brazil nut and the top hat, he put on the black cap. He changed his mind about that marriage. It was not right, he said. It was not human to inflict a fool like Freddy on so sweet a girl, or on any girl, for that matter. After a powerful passage in which he pointed this out, he delivered sentence. Freddy was to take the afternoon train to Blister Regis, repair by the station cab to Blister Towers, and, at Blister Towers, to remain secluded till further notice. Only thus, in his opinion, could the world be rendered safe for the human race. So there was nothing for Freddy to do but ring up the girl Dora and inform her that the big binge was off. The statement was not very well received. "Oh, dear," she said, and Freddy, reading between the lines, could see that what she really meant was, "Oh, hell, why?" Freddy explained that he'd got to go down to the country that afternoon till further notice. The girl's manner changed. Her voice, which had been sniffy, brightened. "Oh, but that's all right," she said. "We shall all miss you, of course, but I can send you the bill."
"Something in that," said Freddy. "Only the trouble is, you see, I can't pay it."
"Why not?"
"I haven't any money."
"Why haven't you any money?" Freddy braced himself.
"Well, the fact is that in a mistaken moment of enthusiasm, thinking wrongly, as it turned out, that I was on a pinch, I betted..."
And in broken accents he told her the whole story. Wasted, of course, because she'd hung up with a sharp cry at the word betted. And about 10 minutes later, after saying,
"Hello? Hello?"
a good many times, he too hung up. Somberly, because something told him the one more girl, whom he had loved, had gone out of his life. And no sooner had he left his rooms and tottered into the street, his intention, and a very sound one, being to make his way to the club and have a few before it was too late, something small and greasy nipped out from the shadows. To cut a long story short, Joseph Waterbury. And Freddy was just about to summon up all that remained of his frail strength after last night's doings and let him have it right in the eyeball, when Joseph Waterbury began to thank him for saving his life. Well, you can't swat a man who's thanking you for saving his life, not if your own is ruled by the noblesse oblige code of the Widgeons. And when he tells you that times are hard and moots the possibility of your being able to spare a trifle, you cannot pass on unheeding. It was a bob that time, and on Freddy's return to London some 3 weeks later, the very day, oddly enough, when he read in the Morning Post that a marriage had been arranged and would shortly take place between Percival Alexander, eldest son of Gregory Hotchkiss, Esquire and Mrs. Hotchkiss, and Dora, only daughter of the late Sir Ramsworthy Pinfold and Lady Pinfold, it was two. Freddy not having anything smaller on him. And there you are. There was a thoughtful silence. "And so it goes on," said the crumpet.
"So it goes on,"
said the senior bean.
The junior bean agreed that so it went on.